Well, good evening, brethren and sisters. The story of Lear is at first sight nothing short of tragic. Even the first we hear of her, which is her name, in Genesis 29 verse 16, bespeaks a mournful and pathetic figure. The name means weary, which is hardly an optimistic choice by a parent, and which would hardly encourage lively friendships or social extroversion. We might be tempted to say, what's in a name? But they can be deceptively powerful. Imagine, say, if your addresses tonight had been given by brothers Woebegone Wharton and Turgid Toms, perhaps your preconceptions would have been a little different. Especially in a time when the meanings of names were very much more actively used, and when names could be changed if they did not suit their bearer, we might think of Benoni turning to Benjamin, to have a name such as Lear, is more than telling. It is almost certain that Lear was the firstborn child of Laban and his wife. The word in Genesis 29 is used to describe a firstborn, and not just the older of two people. Undoubtedly, Laban and his wife would have been hoping for a boy. Perhaps this name with which they endowed their firstborn reflects the struggle of childbirth and the disappointment, if that's not too strong a word, that the labour had not been adequately rewarded. We will conclude on a positive note, but let's first remind ourselves of events in Lear's life that would lead us to think of Lear as a figure of woe. And let's turn to Genesis 29. For now, because I will be quoting from that chapter. First is the description of her that we are presented with. Again, Genesis 29, verse 16, that she had weak eyes. An odd description, especially as it is offered as a contrast to the description of her sister. Perhaps we have heard the Jerusalem Bible translation of this phrase. There was no sparkle in Lear's eyes, but Rachel was shapely and beautiful, which is a clearer contrast. The very fact that a comparison is made is revealing in itself. Not only was she consigned to be perpetually weary, but also to be in the shadow of a lively and attractive younger sister. So to borrow a modern phrase, we could say that Lear would not have been the life and soul of a party, in contrast to her sister Rachel. The second occasion we find in Lear's life, 7 years after meeting Jacob, in Genesis 29 verse 23, is her father Laban's act of callous but calculated cruelty, which James mentioned earlier, giving Lear to Jacob as a wife in place of Rachel. Laban's excuse, "It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one," verse 26, is quite frankly rather lame. He had had 7 years while Jacob was working for him to find a suitor for Lear, if that custom was so important to him. I think it is quite plain, as James mentioned, that Laban wished to extract another profitable 7 years of work from Jacob, and Lear was a convenient tool in his deception. So we see here Lear, a firstborn child, used as if she had no feeling or value whatsoever. Then, soon after, we have the emotional devastation after the very first night of her marriage. We read in verse 25 of this chapter how Jacob was appalled when he discovered that he had married Lear instead of Rachel, and in verse 28 how he married Rachel as soon as possible after Lear's bridal week was over. Undoubtedly, Jacob acted dutifully and kindly towards Lear, but without any of the deep affection that he had held for her sister throughout those 7 years of labour. As if to double the ignominy, marriage for Lear might have been a way to escape the shadow of her sister, but even this pleasure was denied her. So even the first few days of her marriage, which for most people, I imagine, consist of unparalleled joy, were not as happy for Lear as they might have been. It seems as if the marriage continued in this way. In verse 30 of this chapter, we read that Jacob loved Rachel more than Lear. But the most telling example of the nature of the relationship occurs in Genesis 30, verses 14 to 16, which we can turn to now, in which Leah hires Jacob from Rachel in return for some of her son Reuben's mandrakes. It is clear from this fact who Jacob usually favoured. But also in this passage, we get a rare insight into the interaction between Leah and her sister. She says, "Wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take my son's mandrakes too?" This statement reveals a very deep pain that Leah felt at the injustice of the situation. "Wasn't it enough," she says, "that you took away my husband?" As we might imagine, having to share a marriage unequally with her sister, whom she had stood behind for most of her life, was taking its toll. In Genesis 31, which we turn to now, we read of the relationship that both Rachel and Leah had with their father. In this chapter, in verses 14 to 16, "Do we still have any share in the inheritance of our father's estate? Does he not regard us as foreigners? Not only has he sold us, but he has used up what was paid for us. Surely all the wealth that God took away from our father belongs to us and our children. So do whatever God has told you." This, of course, is Rachel and Leah talking to their husband Jacob. This does not sound like evidence of a meaningful and affectionate bond between daughters and their father. It certainly seems as if both women had been as fully distanced from their father's family as they had been integrated into Jacob's family. Certainly in the case of Leah, we get the impression that she was dutiful in her own family. Agreeing to marry Jacob in the first place is evidence of this. But it seems that she had no desire to do for her family more than was required. The very last time we read of Leah alive, in Genesis 33, verses 1 and 2, which we can turn to now, her secondary position is confirmed. "Because Jacob feared for the safety of his family when meeting his brother Esau, he put Rachel and Joseph, the most favoured, at the back of the group, with Leah and her children in front, and then the maidservants with their children in front of them." We could have no clearer illustration than this of the hierarchy between Jacob's wives, confirming our earlier conclusions. Lastly, from the life of Leah, we might consider her death. While the death of Rachel is recorded, we don't know exactly when Leah died. The occasion is not mentioned amongst the rest of the narrative. But we do know from Genesis 49 verse 31 that she was buried in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre in Canaan, which Abraham bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite. And this was in the region that Isaac had been living while he was alive. We also know that Rachel had died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, Bethlehem, in Genesis 35, verse 19, as the family group returned from Paddan Aram, the home of Laban, towards Canaan, where Isaac was living. It makes sense, therefore, to conclude that Leah died while Jacob and his family were living at Mamre in Canaan, originally with Isaac before he died, and before the family moved to Egypt. Abraham and Sarah, as well as Isaac and Rebekah, had been buried in that same place, and Jacob requested to be buried there too. So in death, at least, Leah was afforded a great honour that her sister had been denied, although she would have been unaware of this fact, just as she was, presumably, unaware of her place in the lineage of Christ through her son Judah. So hopefully you will agree that the story of Leah is not, from her perspective, a very happy tale. But as much as we see sorrow and what we might tentatively call injustice, we also see a shining example of perseverance and resolute faith throughout the lifelong trials that she endured. Perhaps the best insight we can gain into her personal thoughts and attitudes can be gleaned from the record of what she said. Of the selection that we have recorded, by far the largest proportion is devoted to naming her children. The two other occasions have already been mentioned. These are recorded in Genesis 29 and from verse 31 onwards, which we can turn to now. Genesis 29 verse 32, we read of the birth of her firstborn, who was of course also Jacob's firstborn, Reuben, meaning, behold, a son. It is as if Leah is asking with this name what more she could do for her husband than to provide a firstborn son. This sentiment is borne out in what she says later in that same verse. It is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now. As if this triumphant event might ease the pain of her earlier rejection by granting her greater favour in the eyes of Jacob. But in verse 33 of this chapter, at the birth of Simeon, meaning heard, we read that this did not come to pass. Because the Lord heard that I am not loved, still not loved, he gave me this one too. So even through the love Jacob must have had for his own children, Leah did not feel as if she herself was loved. Nevertheless, her hope of better times to come remained undiminished. In verse 34, Now at last my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him three sons. So even after at least a year and a half after the birth of Reuben, I would suggest it was probably longer than this, Jacob had not come round to accepting Leah as an equal with Rachel. But Leah nevertheless retained a vestige of hope that this might happen in the future. Her next exclamation, in verse 35 of this chapter, is both terribly sad and very encouraging. At the birth of Judah, meaning praise, she says, "This time I will praise the Lord." Here it seems that she has given up hope of ever finding solace in her earthly marriage, and instead she turns to God, to whom she offers praise. In this fact, she is a wonderful example to us. We can be encouraged likewise to extol the Lord at all times, as the psalmist says, and not just when the things of this earthly life satisfy our emotional needs. After this apparent shift in focus from seeking temporal happiness to fulfilling the eternal duty of mankind to praise the Lord, we see a slightly different side of Leah in Genesis chapter 30, which we can turn to now. The birth of her maidservant's two sons, Gad and Asher, elicit the following exclamations. "What good fortune," 30 verse 11, and "How happy I am, the women will call me happy," verse 13. So in the birth of these two sons, Leah does not rest her hope of what she still deeply desired on a personal level, the love of Jacob, but rather she is overwhelmingly thankful for what she has been given. Perhaps it is the fact that it is not her own children, but the children of her maidservant that gives her this somehow broader perspective. The birth of Leah's fifth and sixth sons unites these ideas of continuing hope and of praising God. Let us look at the last two of her soliloquies, which are recorded in Genesis 30 verses 18 and 20. "God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband," matching, of course, the name Zebulun, meaning "there is recompense." And "God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will treat me with honour, because I have borne him six sons." So Leah continues to hope for what she instinctively desired, but now offers praise to God at the same time. We know, of course, that at the end of her life, after Rachel died, she was with Jacob. Although as to the strength of that relationship, compared to Jacob's marriage with Rachel, we can only speculate. So now let us summarise. First, we considered the great weight of woe that Leah carried around on her shoulders. her being named after her mother's disappointment, her being always overshadowed by her younger sister in both appearance and personality, her being used as a bargaining tool by her father, her unequal part in a marriage to a man whose affection she desperately craved, but never, it seems, received. But then we considered her enduring faith and dogged hope, evidenced particularly by the naming of her children. All of her children's names are extremely positive, in contrast to her own name, and also to the name that Rachel gave her last child. I think that the phrase long-suffering suits her well, but perhaps that perseverance is the theme which emerges most strongly from this account. Her burial next to the patriarchs themselves is surely a sign to us that her perseverance will be rewarded, and her place in the line of Christ surely tells of a strong and good character. So in her example we can take great encouragement. When we experience times of trouble, and we all do, no matter how richly or otherwise we are blessed with material possessions, we can remember that if we persevere in faith and hope, as she did, as well as in the love of God, then we too will be rewarded for our struggle.